Good morning, and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for March 6th. We made it out of February into March by the grace of God. And so this morning we thought we would talk about religion in America. Right?
Yeah.
Do you have anything to say about that? I'm just kidding. So I, for many years, have been on a, not many years, a few months, have been noticing the religious nature of minimalism. And it's been irritating me because moving into a tiny home and getting rid of all of your stuff is become a spiritual and moral exercise that seems like it can save you from your sins of overconsumption and make you happy. It answers all the important questions of life. And at the same time, you've been really irritated about people going to see the shack or threatening to go see the shack, which is more obviously a religious thing. But I think that religion is so pervasive in our culture in all the wrong ways that I wanted to complain about it for a few minutes.
So what do you mean when you say religion?
Well, so people aren't really Christian anymore, you know, or what if they ever were. But
something has to fill the void.
Yeah, something has to fill the void. You still have to answer the basic questions of life, like what is truth and who is God? Obviously, I am God. So who will worship me? How will I worship myself best and be most happy? If you don't have an explicit religious system that answers those questions, you're going to find ways to answer them for yourself, which has been going on for quite a long time in the West. But I'm irritated that people don't really hear themselves. It seems to me are not hearing the religious nature of some of the fads that we culturally are using to fill the gaping maw of existential crisis.
Right.
And I think minimalism is the most obvious one, but I think there are a lot of them around right now. So
it's very Confucian. I mean, this is how you are. It's a godless. I mean, minimalists don't necessarily believe in any kind of deity, but it's a practice that's supposed to bring about order and
happiness.
And happiness, if you do it. And we were
like
watching
ultimate
this,
happiness, right. Not just sort of day to day happiness.
They found the answer, and the answer is getting rid of all your stuff. And we found that we I mean, it's not a new answer. This is...
No, it's a Buddhist answer, right? It's
right.
Quite old answer.
The cynical answer, the stoic answer, it's been around for ages, but it's new to our culture. I mean, it hasn't been something that
people because
have been...
we tried the buying all the stuff answer.
Right.
We tried that answer to cultural, or as a religious option. We've tried total materialism as a way of life and a way of finding happiness. And so, of course, a lot of people have noticed that actually didn't work. And so
we were watching
swing back the other way to say that getting rid of all your stuff will be the answer.
Right.
Except I'm pretty sure these people are going to find that they're going to need something else in like 10 years.
So we were watching a video last night about the documentary yesterday about these two men who had been successful corporate people, and both coming from really broken,
just devastatingly
family
broken
homes, right?
Homes,
and they just both at some point decided to just chuck it all, and I don't know if they chucked their jobs.
They did.
Okay,
they
so
wrote
they
a book.
Write a book about getting rid of all your stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they go on tour. They mm-hmm. go around the country, trying to spread the quote unquote gospel of minimalism. They're very devoted. They're the apostles of minimalism.
Minimalism.
Right, and they go to conferences, whatever it might be, and the documentary followed them into their homes, and they're quite minimal.
Yeah, but I'm deeply minimal, as in there's like the chair and the table and the single jacket.
Yeah. Who is it that who's that Japanese person that says you take your charge up the object and you say, does Marie this make Kondo. Me happy? Yeah.
Yeah.
If it doesn't make you happy, Kondo you get rid Marie. Of it. Yeah, they repeated that phrase. If it doesn't make me happy,
why? If it doesn't bring me joy.
Right. Right.
Then I'm gonna get rid of it. And so they did get rid of everything because that brought
them. How many
them
kids
joy.
Do you think we'd have left if we
I know.
Yes.
I love that meme. I held up each thing in my house and I threw away all the vegetables and my treadmill.
I think I'd be left with like a box of Captain Crunch and
well no, I don't like Captain Crunch.
I love Captain Crunch, it's my favorite cereal.
I would have a large brie and
we'd probably keep the
wine. I actually would have a lot of stuff. Yeah.
I really enjoy all of our stuff. I can't think of really too much stuff I'd like to throw away, although we have a lot of stuff.
I would throw away all the children's toys and the Xbox because that doesn't bring me any joy.
Can you throw away other people's stuff that doesn't give you joy?
So,
I mean, if other people's belongings don't give you joy, can you throw them away?
Yeah, in the minimalists talk about how to make your children minimalists. And they have various sort of activities that you can do to get your children on board with their new lifestyle that they're going to be having.
That should be fun.
What and I haven't listened to that. I listened to that one a long time ago. But I think it involved, I think it's called a packing party where you pack up all of the child's stuff with the child. Like it's a big game. You have a party. And I'm pretty sure you put it away. I don't. Know that you get rid
I just
of
can't
it
seem that see that going well. I mean, come on, kids, let's pack up all your toys and put them away where you can never have them again.
Okay, but we did just. I mean, this is an interesting question for us because we did just decide to clean our whole house, mm-hmm. and our children were collecting garbage, which I think is a moral and religious failing on their part. That when you collect and keep garbage. Of course, what is the definition of garbage? You have a deep rooted spiritual problem, and so it's not like stuff is an easy thing for human beings to cope with. You know, it's not like we have a really good and historically forever have had a really good way of thinking about material possessions. I think always we have an idolatry of mm-hmm. material possessions one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me about about minimalism is that you still have the problem of stuff. You just answer the question by getting rid of all of it, yeah. which actually doesn't answer the question. I think you still have the basic human problem of sin. So, but the way that sin is defined in this worldview is that you own things. Too many things.
Right, you identify the problem as something else. I mean, that's a classic religious move. You identify, or the classic quasi-religious move is you identify something other than sin as the problem and then deal with that thing.
And then you deal with that thing. And right. then you have solved that problem, and so you then are able to live the good life. It's really interesting.
So the shack solved the problem of human guilt by making a god who doesn't...
have any guilt.
Or doesn't impose any requirement on human beings, right? So the sin for the God of the Shack is its own punishment. So it's not that God's mad at you. It's just, you know, you're hurting yourself and
you have a bad life.
You have a bad life, but God, that does away with the guilt problem, right? So mm-hmm. you might still have to have the sin problem, but the sin becomes merely a problem because it's like too much stuff cluttering up.
You have too cluttering much
clutter. Up your soul. So you got to declutter, but you're not in trouble.
Yeah.
there's not a guilt aspect to it.
And once you've done that, you really are then okay. I mean, in each of these sort of systems, you can humanly solve the problem.
Because
mm-hmm. you really can get rid of all your things. Like, it's impossible for some people to fathom doing that, but it is humanly possible to completely get rid of all your stuff and have a single... perfectly cut jacket and a laptop and then like your coffee. So you actually, you know, each thing that you own is imbued with it with perfection,
mm-hmm.
in the modern sense, you don't have anything that is sort of maybe out of date, or that you're able to signal with the three things that you own your moral righteousness.
Yeah, it was very the outward markers of virtue. It was the ways that you signal your
haircut.
And that's classic religion too. I mean, that's what the Pharisees were doing with their blowing trumpets in the.
So yeah. if you couldn't be a good religious minimalist, I would say, if you were wearing jeans that are, you know, from 15 years ago and are obviously cut wrong.
Right.
And if your shoes are not, you know, the proper shoes, where one of them is sent, you know, a pair of them is sent abroad to the children of Africa. When you buy a pair, an African child gets a pair of shoes. Then you, that each item that you own has to signal your moral purity.
Right.
And
that you eat, and that you, I mean, every, that's, I mean, it's connected, I guess, with the buy local, eat local, only never have plastic bags at the grocery store. Only make sure that the products you wear were made by
sustainable methods.
So in all of that, you know, you're establishing your own righteousness. You're finding a way to justify your existence, and to yourself and to others. And then, but that gives you a platform from which to point down toward those who are not justifying their existence in the way you are, and so you become.
What was interesting about the documentary is that they would have, you know, the minimalist walking on just a bit blank sandy beach, just him, the blue sky, his blue shirt, his perfect hair. And then they would cut to a scene of people on Black Friday beating each other over TV.
Yeah.
Okay, so obviously, we could say that in the West, there are some material consumption issues. Like, if you go to Walmart and beat another human to a pulp over a TV,
there's a problem.
There's a problem. But those two, like, you have two extremes there. It's kind of like a straw man. I think you build this, like, this picture of the extreme thing, and you lump the entire rest of humanity into that. You solve that problem, but then
both have deified their stuff.
Yes.
One has deified it by accumulation, the other has deified it by subtraction. But it's a deification, because you have the chair.
The perfect chair.
The perfect chair. You have the Platonic ideal chair, and
though. Like, I think I would be happier if
And there's nothing wrong with it.
Chair.
Yeah.
No, and a perfect handbag. I mean, I think part of the reason in my life why I suffer from real depression is because I have almost found the perfect handbag, but if I had the perfect handbag and the perfect shoes, I would be morally good and happy. And I've been thwarted in that search. So you shouldn't look at me like that, because
I've never understood the handbag thing.
You don't.
I don't get the handbag thing.
But that is, like, that's the measure of true happiness. If you have the perfect handbag, then you will have reached nirvana. Like, you won't need to go to heaven, because you will have this handbag. That's fundamentally true. We just need to set that aside as a basic human truth, and then talk about this other problem. It's not a problem for me.
But there's nothing wrong. Like, okay, so is there something inherently evil about minimalism, or is there something inherently evil about having less than minimal?
Less than minimal.
Or more than, how would you describe that?
Less
than. More than minimal lifestyle. Was there anything inherently wrong with that? No.
Okay, I think if you are beating someone to get their stuff,
well, right.
Then there's a problem.
Well, yeah, right, of course. But, I mean, if someone wants to to simplify.
Own a lot of things.
Or not simplify.
Yeah.
That inherently, is there anything wrong with
are
that?
Are you morally obligated and religiously obligated to simplify your life down so that you can live in a tiny home? And if you don't do that, are you a bad person? And this movie would say you are a bad person.
Or just an unhappy person, and you don't know why you're unhappy. And the reason you're unhappy is because you're not a minimalist.
Because
not everyone is getting into fisticuffs at Walmart over the next.
I know. What do you buy? What can you buy at Walmart that would be worth beating another person for?
I'm
interested in what that might be.
What that would be.
I've never gone out there on Black Friday. Maybe I should.
But it's not the act. It's not the discipline. If you want to discipline yourself in that way or not, that's totally fine. There's freedom there. But it's the inherent religious value in the act that has now become a platform again for self-righteousness and hypocrisy. And it all goes to the classic human misdiagnosis of the human problem. It's something else. It's someone else. It's what I own. It's what I don't own. It's what I... it's the way I'm praying. It's not the way I'm praying. It's the works that I'm doing. I need to do different works or better works or more works. And it's all the classic problem is sin. And the reality is you can't deal with that. You are unable to take care of your own sin. And so the sooner people realize that, the sooner they become Christians.
And that's going well.
Right, right. Well, you don't want to realize that. No human being, it's just such an offense to human pride to say that human beings can't fix it.
Yeah.
I can't fix myself. I can't make myself better. I can't
make myself happy.
And how dare God not be pleased with my efforts?
Yeah. So that on the opposite side, we've been watching this really great sort of reality show called The Manor, which is where people from 2001, I think it was May, go back and try to live as if it was 100 years ago in Edwardian England. Right. So what I thought was interesting about this program was that there's this sense, and it's certainly at the turn of the century, but not this century, but the last one, that the West was Christian at its roots. Right. So I was watching this, and of course they go to church at some point, and they say morning prayer.
And if only we could get back to those simpler times.
If only we could get back to those simpler times, because I think that's what the minimalist would say. Let's go back to our nostalgic past.
Before we all had electronic devices that we were looking at. And
yeah, with no iPhone and no TV. And then
the peaceful English agrarian.
Yes, agrarian lifestyle.
Right.
Okay, so we're watching this, and it is so shocking. I mean, it's sort of genuinely evil. I almost became a socialist while watching this program, because the family that became this, they for the period of the show, they were the Lord and the Lady, and they had to be right. called Lord and
so
Lady.
We should back up and explain the manner, right? It's a reality show, and people had to apply to play various roles in the Edwardian manor house, and it was a large house of an actual noble person. So you would,
but the family all came the, to live
so
there
you,
wasn't
just
noble.
The classic stratification of the from the yeah. upstairs and downstairs, mm-hmm. the servants who served downstairs and the servants who served upstairs, the lowest downstairs servant being the scullery maid and the hall boy.
Who lived in the hall.
The oversexed hall boy. And then above the over the upstairs servants, the highest being the butler and
the housekeeper.
And all the stratification, the first footman, second footman, third, all those roles had to be filled by, 21st century people who had to research and then dress and then act exactly as they would have acted
in Edwardian England.
And the Lord, too.
Lord
and his
lady
and his family.
The rules,
and all, everyone had to follow the rules, and it quickly broke down. But that was the...
They tried really hard.
But, it was just... If you're the scullery maid, you're working, 16, 17 hours a day, mm-hmm. every day. Mm-hmm. And the only time you got... off, I guess, was to go to church on Sunday, but then you had to walk
to church and walk home for 2 miles while everybody else, the footman and the housekeeper and the butler, would ride in the carriage. But this the maids, the female maids, and the had to walk the 2 miles to church and back.
And you had, when you got back, you had all the work piled up that hadn't been done while you were at church. So there was no sense of the Levitical law, okay, Sabbath, all my servants, myself, everyone, no work.
Yeah.
We're giving everyone a rest. Nope, there was none of that. There was no sense of, when you read the slavery laws in the Old Testament, slaves were supposed to be part of the family. They were taking part in the feasts and the festivals and the Sabbaths and all of the ritual sacrifices that were taking place as a family, the household slaves were part of. And in Edwardian England, these servants were far worse than slaves, I think. They had to be separated from the family for 3 months or longer, depending on the season. And they had no break.
And it was immoral. Like, it's interesting in the program how quickly everybody, or not everybody, not the servants, the people playing the servants didn't feel this way at all. But the person who played the Lord quickly embodied the role and felt comfortable.
He was fine. He had a great time.
Yeah, and he, you could see that he was going to easily understand that he, in his essence, was better just than the person who was a scullery maid. Like he, that got, that there was,
it wasn't
something
just that
about
he was,
him.
He had been randomly chosen for that role.
Right.
In the show. No, he actually came to the point.
He came to believe about himself that he was good and that the scullery maid deserved whatever she got.
Right.
And so it also, the relationships with each other really broke down. There, the strictures of the
licking sound is the dog, just to let you know.
Just, you know, we managed to,
he's decided to do some personal hygiene while we're sitting here doing our,
of course, as usual, because it's Monday morning. So what really interested me was that how completely godless it was.
Yeah.
Because I really do think that Christians in this century think that the past was Christian.
Right.
Which leads me to talk about the Brady Bunch for just a minute.
We've gone from religion, in which we talked mostly about minimalism.
Well, no, it is all going to tie back. I'm going to tie it all up with a bow.
Okay,
because I have had this impression, and again, I'm not from here, of America and the West is a Christian at its roots system. And so I asked you, I've never seen the Brady Bunch. I'm trying to watch the Brady Bunch. And in the one that we watched, there was this little idol that they had to return to its idolatrous place. And it was giving them bad luck. And my question to you was, when you were watching the Brady Bunch,
that's the famous Hawaii episode, in which they did not jump the shark.
I can't fathom that. Right, that is miraculous. Like, right. That's divinely.
That became the theme of the movie, the Brady movie or whatever.
Yeah, and I think I figured out why watching the Brady movie first is confused me more about all things. But so I asked you, when you were watching this in the 70s, or when you were watching TV in general, sitcoms, would you have thought of American society as Christian?
I mean, I was a kid in the 70s, and my parents made me go to church every Sunday, and my mom was a believer at the time, and so I guess I assumed the basic Christianity in the country, yes.
Because that can't possibly be true. I mean, I don't think there's a nostalgic Christian past for America. There certainly isn't one for Edwardian England. And I don't think there is one for America either. If you're looking back over the cultural landscape of the last 100 years in America, you are not looking at biblical Christian culture, really, at all. You might have a veneer. So my question was, when you come to the 80s and you have the moral majority, or the people who would have said, we need to return America to its Christian roots, and we need to restore the family to the center. What are they talking about? Where is that that great utopia that must have existed before? Because I don't think it was there. I don't think we could have returned to a glorious Christian past at all.
Well, look, okay, so there's always been, if Jesus is right, well, since Jesus is right.
If Jesus, I don't
and,
know. I
mean, and there's the few, not many, will find the narrow road. I mean, we shouldn't assume that even in a Christian nation, there's a vast majority of people are actually Christians. There's a nominalism or a nominal Christianity that I think held sway over the United States for many, many years. Whereas I think most people went to church and adopted Christian virtue, but didn't trust in Jesus Christ for their sins. Right, so that was breaking down though in the 70s, okay, because the Brady Bunch was a sitcom that was created after 68, you know, and that was the...
But even in Leave It to Beaver, which I have now watched in
but that was the 50s one, right?
They did not go to church. They did not have scenes of the family.
They did talk about church.
Not really.
Yeah, there was an episode where Beaver and Wally were talking about something about church. They were mentioning
like
church
one time.
And there was a couple episodes where they're coming home from church, right? But they didn't, right?
It wasn't the fabric of the. I mean, it wasn't. Leave It to Beaver is not a Christian program.
It's more wholesome.
Yeah. Okay. So wholesome, but you
the Brady Bunch maybe is less wholesome. It's not. But it's not unwholesome. It's not
the Edwardian Manor House.
What shocked you about the Brady Bunch?
That it's wholesome. What I'm trying to put my family. I was sort of really shocked
by the tiki doll.
The tiki doll, and the. The servant who lives with them.
Oh, Alice.
Where did they get the live-in servant? And what did the
mother
do?
They have six kids.
Do?
They have to have a live-in servant.
Okay.
I guess.
I mean, where's my live-in servant? And I felt like my whole sense of the
He's
West.
A successful architect. She's a homemaker.
So
she has to have a servant to help her, a maid to help her do that.
What does she do all day?
Well, she and Alice decorate the house and make lunches for the kids.
Do really want to return to this nostalgic past because this isn't working out for me. Yeah,
and they took Alice along with them on the vacation. That was more biblical, actually. They took the servant.
She was really part of the family.
Yeah. And she got her day off and she had her own room and they took care of her.
Yeah. No, that was nice. It was disorienting. I was profoundly disoriented watching the Brady Bunch and this Manor program because nothing about either of those things resembles my life now. And but neither does the minimalist.
We do have a servant's quarters. It's upstairs, though.
We do. Where I'm educating the children myself, which is just catastrophically sad that I would do that. But the minimalists, you know, I think are trying to go back to something that they imagine must have existed because they, in the first part of the film, they describe, you know, the rise of advertising through the last many decades and how it's sort of reached this fever pitch so that it takes over, it's taken over, and our whole consciousness is shaped and formed by advertising. If we could remove ourselves from that sin, then we would have sort of pure consciousness and happiness. Which is interesting because I really think in the Brady Bunch and the Edwardians wanted more stuff. You know, if you could have more rich food and more Hawaiian vacations, then that was a sign of your rightness and right standing before God and others. So you swing back and forth, you know, my question is, did Christians in both of these systems, if they were sort of Christian-ish, did they, how did the Christian think about his place before God? You know, how could, if a Christian had wandered onto the set of the Brady Bunch, would they have thought, this is wrong or weird or, you know,
I don't understand what you found so wrong about the Brady. I mean, I'm not saying they were Christians. I'm saying what is it that was particularly? I mean, it's a fairly wholesome show.
Okay, so what? But that's what. What is the word wholesome? Like, that's what people.
Okay, so there's no explicit sex. There's no cursing. There's, you know, the situations they get themselves into are fairly benign. There's, you know, a bully at school or gossip going around or Jan feeling like the middle child. And, you know, there's these kind of benign family drama stuff that goes on. And
I don't know. It felt pervasively not Christian to me watching it. I'm trying to put my finger on why.
I mean,
it's the Formica countertops.
But I don't think the sitcom culture was ever Christian. I'm not.
Yeah, so I think that's what I'm surprised, because I when I come back to America, I think, and people talk about having an American culture or a Christian culture in America, I'm expecting as an outsider to see that.
Well, by that, I mean, I think they mean, like, you can't just bare your breasts on TV like you can in France. Like, you can't.
Yeah, because the French are so evil.
They are. They're horrible. But you can't just do like the Europeans do.
Okay,
right? So you have to be more, at least in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s, I would say you couldn't have a European stance toward sex or toward language. On the network side of the television set.
That's not a biblically based.
I would say it's a vestige of the cultural Christianity that we'd had for years.
Which I just don't think is really Christian. I don't think the cultural Christianity really resembled Christianity.
Well, no, it was more of a deistic, theistic compromise that. With Christianity, the incorporation of basic decent values. I don't think it was Christianity. No, I mean I think that's what people mean when they talk about Christian culture. I don't think they mean everybody was a believing, regenerate.
Okay, but I do
predestined elect, heaven bound person. That they were talking about the way that the Christian church affects a culture. And I think there's an interesting point there. I mean, Christians in a culture are like salt, right? So it doesn't mean that everyone's Christian, but it does mean the rot is held back a little bit, right? So that there's a little bit of restraint to the depravity that human culture ultimately devolves into, so long as you have a core of actual gospel believing Christians in a particular culture. So you have, I think that's what did preserve the United States for a couple of centuries.
Okay, but I do think that there was, maybe for many ordinary Christians, a real confusion about the way in which the culture was Christian. And
well, it was surface, moral, right? It was a moral.
Surface moral, but I think people in the church felt like that surface moral Christianity was so important and critical and had a greater impact than a stronger impact than it was really having. So it, you know, if you can just have families intact, which I would say is sort of a surface moral kind of expression of Christianity, then you would really be okay. You know, the culture, individuals would be okay as long as you had intact families. And so there was focus on intact families. Focus on the family. And if you could get people to behave properly and have prayer in school, then you would have a Christian culture, and that would equal being salt and light.
Well, so no doubt, I think the moral majority and all the movements in the 80s that sought to elect Christians to office and kind of allied the Republican Party and the evangelical wing of the Christian church together had that aim, is to create a cultural morality, or preserve really a cultural morality that they saw being eroded by the values that sprung up into the public sphere in the 70s and 60s. And so there, and I don't think
I think that was a pointless thing.
Oh, yeah, because what they were trying to preserve was a veneer, right? Because it wasn't like, it wasn't as if in the 1960s or 50s or 40s or further you go back, that we really did have a core commitment to virtue. We had a core commitment to order, I would say, and basic decency, I would say, but the human heart was a human heart, and there was always sin at the core of it.
In the Edwardian manner, there was this close-set veneer of decency and order that essentially undermined the humanity of a big section of the household.
Right. So the lady walks through a room, and if one of the lower servants is in the room, she has to go and put her face in the corner, not the lady, the servant, so as not to disturb the lady by the face of the servant. And that was proper, orderly way of doing things. That's not your class, so you don't even look at each other. It's amazing. So yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that would make you want to be a socialist.
I had a renewed gratefulness for the suffrage movement and for, I think economic change that made it possible for people to get away and go do other kinds of work. But again, I think many of the changes that brought about that kind of manor house existence were surface. There wasn't a fundamental valuation of the human person that changed the system.
Right.
It was just that people got away from it and went on to, dehumanize other people, which I think the minimalism will fall into eventually.
Well,
in the valuation of having few things, even though you say that it's important to love people and not things, your moral stance towards material goods means that you have to judge and belittle people who have too many things.
Well, that I think that's right. That's what you saw in that video or the documentary when they would flash from the man with the perfect hair on the beach to the fat people in Walmart fighting,
right,
over goods. And so the fat people in Walmart fighting were less human than
the person on the beach who's
right.
achieved enlightenment.
Right.
And moral purity. So you still have the same problem of not valuing people and overvaluing things.
Right.
I think you've just fallen right into the same trap that you were trying to avoid.
Exactly.
Well, I didn't realize we'd be able to solve it on that level. Really, this has been great.
I
won't even have to blog about it later, which I will still do anyway. I read this really wonderful article, which I wish I could find. I'll have to look for it again, about how still in the West we have, even for the minimalist, we are not materialistic enough. We don't have a proper understanding of the material world and ourselves in it. And so we always are going to misjudge and misuse things and people because our theology of materialism isn't good enough.
We've suppressed the creator and
right.
exalted the creature.
Right.
And so we are going to be off until we put that back in order.
Which we won't ever do.
Well, until God puts that back in order
doomed.
For us. Right.
There is no hope. That's the point of this whole podcast, is that you should despair. And there's nothing you can do to make it better.
That's cheerful.
Yeah, and that brings me, I just think we should just say one more thing about the war on Lent.
You're
I'm really roiling today.
There does seem to be a war on Lent.
The war on Lent.
What it seems to be is a rear guard action by evangelicals who adopt the regulative principle, which is we ought not to worship in any way that can't be grounded in a prescription of Scripture or something that Scripture commands us to do.
Well, I don't know how you could do that, because where in Scripture does it say that you can have the big screens and the guitar?
Well, I think the regular principle people would say, well, we can't have big screens. A lot of them would. Right. So.
Okay.
So these are like the classic traditionalist Baptists, the Presbyterians who don't allow for ornaments in their church in any way, right? The bare bones liturgy or non-liturgy.
It is a liturgy, though.
Right. So, but they're upset with evangelicals, more moderate evangelicals, going traipsing along after Anglicans and Lutherans and grabbing the hems of their garments and saying, teach us how to do these things.
Teach us about Lent.
Right. And they see it as, well, we read some of our articles where there's this return to Rome papistry and the reemergence of the law, which is odd because, at least in the Protestant side of things, nobody says you must celebrate or participate in Lent or you are sinning. No one says that. You just do it or not. It's up to you. You don't have to do Lent if you don't want to. It's fine, but if you want to, you can, because we are free in Christ. No. And the ones who are opposing Lent are doing it on the grounds of freedom. We are free from Lent, and so we shouldn't therefore do it, which ironically then is to impose a law
on those who do, which
can't be grounded in Scripture. The regulative principle people are applying a non-biblical worship law on those who are practicing Lent. They can't find the law against Lent in the Bible, but they've got to wage war on it extra biblically.
It's because Anglicans are, Anglicans are evil and they should be suppressed. Okay, so
Carl Truman said that it's okay, he supposes, if on a good day, right, when he wakes up and he doesn't have a headache or he doesn't feel bad, then he's okay with Anglicans.
Doing Lent.
But no one else.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so here, I do need to wrap all of this up with a tight bow, because I tried to liken the Lent wars on Lent to the relationships between the members of the Brady Bunch. And because I'm not from here, I said that Anglicans were like the Marcia of the Brady Bunch. And I thought I was saying, because of the Carl Truman essay, that Anglicans were like the
middle girl child.
The middle child who everyone hates. But in fact, I had called them the beloved and
the golden child, Marcia,
is jealous of Marcia, because I don't actually know the names of the people on this program.
I thought you were saying,
and that's why you agreed with me.
I agreed with you because you were saying something totally different.
I assumed you were saying
that Anglicans occupy a cultural space in the United States because of the history of Episcopalianism in the United States of superiority. You know, the first. We didn't ever have an established church in the United States, but the Episcopal Church was always the establishment church. It's where the aristocrats went.
And I was actually saying that the Anglican Church is like the loathed middle sister,
right,
who nobody wants because they are tainted by Episcopalianism and liberalism. And so no right-thinking Christian evangelical would really like an Anglican because they have so many problems.
I thought you were saying that the move toward practicing Lent on the part of people was like Marcia trying to be like, or Jan trying to be like Marcia, and that evoked the reaction from other Jans who were upset because they don't need to be like Marcia. They don't need to wear a big wig and have the.
Does Marcia wear a wig?
Yeah, there's an episode where she puts on the wig. That was in the movie too.
I'm so confused.
Or Jan puts on the wig. I'm sorry. Jan puts on the wig to compete with Marcia. And it doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm disoriented. I'm struggling to gain a footing in this cultural landscape. I don't understand anything that's really going on. I think that's the... So...
Well, this has been a very strange podcast here. And people are
this
be,
is like... Okay, so you come back to America...
This is like stream of consciousness
and
podcasting.
And you're only...
Well, let's talk about Brady Bunch now, or let's... We're talking about religion and Brady Bunch. And
these
the manner,
are the things that have really been troubling me this week. And as you have occasionally said, it's my podcast and I can talk about whatever I want.
Yeah,
so
it is. I'm just saying it's going to be... People need to just not expect coherence.
No, but I think if you need a break from your Lenten discipline, like your rationality and the things that you... You know, if you're trying to go in sort of a direct line towards Jesus... This will solve you. You can just take a break from that and kind of go in a wide, irrational circle. Is there anything you wanted to talk about or say?
No, I think I'm done. I think you've exhausted.
I've exhausted the whole thing. So, well, that's great. You know, the lesson for this should be that some people should send us in. Questions and topics that they'd like us to talk about. Otherwise, this will happen again. You're welcome. So, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week.